It's my pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Reverend Terry Daniel. She is, of course, the author of these books that you see here on the table. She's been a chaplain and a hospice-trained person who has worked with death and dying and grieving for many years. As I said, she's spoken here before. Please join me in welcoming back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Reverend Terry Daniel.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. Thank you for coming out to see me. And I'm so happy to be talking to you. And gosh, we only have an hour, and there's so much to cover. So to compress everything the best I can, I thought what I would do tonight is focus on, rather than, well, I'm going to just jump in with grief theory. Are any of you here grief counselors or chaplains or familiar with grief work other than in your own personal experience with grief? Yeah, you are? Raise your hand. Hi. Okay, good. So, you heard the term grief work. This term, you probably don't know this, was coined by Sigmund Freud in 1931. He wrote a paper called Mourning and Melancholia. And Freud had a theory about how to deal with grief and loss. And his theory was basically the goal is to delve in and feel your pain for a period of time, but ultimately to stop the pain and to cut off the relationship with the deceased. This was mostly focusing on a loss of somebody who's died. And the idea was to, as he would say, psychically separate from the attachment and the identification with the person. This was the popular theory in psychotherapy for the next 50 or 60 years. Oh, not that long, 30 or 40 years. When the 1960s came around and we began to get exposed to teachings from other cultures after China invaded Tibet and kicked the Buddhists out, and they went to India and eventually to Europe, and Buddhism eventually came to America, those teachings, other ways of looking at death and attachment, started to seep into our culture in the 1950s and 60s. You will remember some of us, the beatniks and Zen, and then of course the hippies, and here we all are now. And we started to open up our minds a little bit about death and loss, and the psychotherapy world kind of followed suit very slowly. They're still dragging behind, but they're changing Freud's approach to grief, and instead of now that the goal is to let go and sever from the relationship, the new terminology that they use is continuing bonds. So you continue the bond with the person, and again, I'm only speaking about death now, so that we borrow from other cultures. Now that we have a multicultural world with the internet and everything, we can see what they do in Africa and what they do in China and what they do in South America with their grief. We've never seen this before the last 20 or 30 years. So now that we're bringing these other practices in, we're becoming more conscious about how to deal with grief and loss because we have all this great new information. For example, in China, when somebody dies, every family has an altar in their house, and when grandmother dies, you put something on the altar. I mean, right here, what are we looking at? The Day of the Dead, very important tradition, same idea. And on the altar, you put food and flowers, and you feed grandmother in the afterlife, and generally, you do that for about a year, and then she's on the altar with the rest of the ancestors. The Day of the Dead tells us a lot about a mix between indigenous religions of the Americas and Catholicism that came in and blended with that. In the Dogara tradition in Africa, I'm just making a few of these out of my head, we know that they have a three-day grief ritual. You're nodding your head. Are you familiar with Sabonfu?
And yeah, my friends were in the first village.
Yeah. So, you know, they teach us that the whole village grieves together. So if there was a tragic death in Sebastopol, we would all be here together right now with a big bonfire and drums and dancing and singing and crying and rituals, and we would do this together for 3 days. So there's all these wonderful traditions that we don't have, because what we have in America instead is your spouse dies or your child dies or your sister dies, we have a funeral, generally in the religious tradition that you inherited from your parents, not necessarily the one you chose,
And after the funeral, for a few weeks, people come to your house and bring casseroles. And after about 3 weeks, they're gone. And you're supposed to get over it. That's what Freud would have said. And of course, we know that it doesn't really work that way. I had a woman in my workshop the other day. You may have heard about this. Her husband was a scuba diver who died in Jenner 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. Did you hear about this story? She was in my workshop. And they were a youngish couple in their 40s. He just went out scuba diving. No one ever expected that this would happen. And she told me that her friends and people in her workplace 3 weeks after the event said, time to move on. Mm. You know, you're over this now, right? Are you okay? Mm. Because her pain made everybody so uncomfortable. So I assume everybody here has had a loss of someone close to them, even a pet or anything. And you probably noticed that your friends don't want to hear about it past a certain point. Even if you don't talk about it, just being in the presence of a grieving person is very uncomfortable for the rest of the world. People can't handle it, so they pull away and they push you away. And part of the reason for that is we're not taught how to deal with death in this culture and with grief. So when you're a little kid, you're taught to speak quietly in the library or to go in a store like this and not steal things. You know, we're taught all this stuff, but no one teaches us how to be with sadness and with grief. And again, when we look at other cultures, we see that death is so much a part of daily life in third world countries and in indigenous traditions that they have the tools for coping with death and grief, and they're not uncomfortable with it. Here in America, and I don't need to tell you this, you know, the medical establishment is all about fix everything, keep everybody alive, patch everything up, we can't let anybody die. I come from a whole family of doctors, 3 of them are ER doctors. So you can imagine what our dinner party conversations are like, because I'm a hospice chaplain and I want people to die when it's time. And I was talking to my brother-in-law, who's been an ER doctor for 30 years, and I was telling him about a case that I know where the person had a reverse feeding tube where they were pumping stuff out of the stomach that was toxic and not in for feeding. And he said to me, well, if you do that, the person will die. And I said, yeah, she's in hospice. That's what's supposed to happen. This pumping of the stuff is just about comfort. So we're in a culture where nobody can deal with this. But it's changing, as you probably know. We have a home funeral movement. Some of you know Jerry Grace Lyons, who lives there. He's a big leader in this movement. Green funerals, conscious dying and conscious grieving. Thankfully, is now a thing, and I'm very grateful to be pretty involved in that movement. So, what I want to talk about is so new ways of looking at grief, not the Freudian way. You've all heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and her stages of grief, which we now know have nothing to do with the actual grief process at all. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross did her research on dying people who were in the hospital, terminal diagnosis, who were dealing with facing their own death. It was never intended to be about grief. And the stages, first you do this, then you do that, you know, denial, acceptance, anger, bargaining, never was supposed to, nothing goes in stages. Stage theories, we just throw those out the window because nothing is linear like that. And it became popular in the grief world just at the same time when this new way of looking at grief was coming in. That's when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross hit the market and it just got sucked up into that. The stage theory is, we just throw that out the window right now. What we have instead with the new theorists and researchers on grief is tasks of grieving, not stages, but tasks, things that you are expected to do to have a healthy trajectory of healing. And so the tasks include things, and you can Google this, you can, I don't know if you're taking notes, but if you want to, the 6 R's, letter R, of grieving, and also the tasks of grieving, if you want to research that. So the tasks are things like this. The first thing you have to do is recognize the loss. So sometimes there's a death where there's not a body. Like, let's say the scuba diver. Let's say he got eaten by the sharks and she never saw a body. She is missing this task of doing the full recognition of the loss. This is part of why we have open caskets and things like this. Helps to see the body. It helps you realize that the death has happened. Or sometimes somebody's abducted. We don't even know what happened to them. People are missing in action in wars. So that's a step that we might miss. And if you miss that step, that's going to complicate the grief healing process. Other steps are revisiting and reenacting the life. So if you have the wonderful opportunity and blessing of sitting with a dying person, someone close to you who is in the dying process, and you have the chance to sit with them and look at the old family photos and talk about old times, this is a really important task of grieving, and that will help with the healing. Reinvesting energy, I'm just saying these from memory, I don't have them written down. Oh, I probably do someplace here, but reinvesting your energy. So if you've been a caretaker of someone who is sick and has died, a lot of interesting stuff happens there. Not only do you lose the person, but you lose the role that you were so comfortable with. When the person dies, your first feeling is relief that the caregiving is over, and the second feeling is what?
Emptiness.
What am I going to do now?
All of the above, plus
guilt.
Guilt. Right, for feeling relieved. So the what am I going to do now is where you reinvest your energy. And the woman, the scuba diver wife, told me that she went to grief counseling and they told her to get a hobby, which, you know, is kind of reinvesting energy, but you just can't get a hobby when you're decimated. So how do you reinvest the energy? And that's what I think I'm going to stop and focus on, because that fits with this little ritual we're going to do tonight. Think about it as energy. Going out and doing a hobby is an activity, but what drives that activity is the energy behind it, right? So if your energy is all caught up in sadness and guilt and grief and mourning, which is fine, it's the energy that you want to move to something else. Not the activities of your body every day. Do you see the difference? It's on an energetic level. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, how to move that energy. That's what I teach in my workshops, is how to go into that, what I call contracted energy of grief and pain. It just feels like this, right? And how to open it up to an expanded, contracted versus expanded. I also call it insulated versus ventilated. Ventilated, you can take a deep breath, but you know how it feels when you have a trauma or a loss. You can't breathe, right? So it's in your body, and all the grief counseling and the hobbies in the world is not going to loosen that up from the body and get it to be ventilated again. And that kind of leads me to my rant about grief counseling and grief groups. And grief counseling is great for a specific purpose. I'll come back to that. Grief groups. I have seen people who've been going to a monthly grief support group for 25 years for a stillborn baby 25 years ago. Or people in their 80s whose spouse died of a natural death at an expected age. It's not a trauma when your 85-year-old husband or father dies. It's expected and natural. You do not need counseling for that. And these grief groups, sometimes people will go and they meet every month and they tell their story over and over and over again. Then a new person comes to the group and tells her story. Then everyone else tells their story again so that the new person can hear it. And that's all that happens. It's an endless cycle of wallowing in the story. Now, I don't want to dismiss that completely, because being heard and telling your story is extremely important in the process. That's one of the tasks, to be able to be heard. But you can't stay there forever. So you want a forum, a venue where you can tell your story and be heard and be supported. But then you have to move on to some more tools. And these grief groups where people are going for 25 years, the problem there is they're not giving them any tools for growth. Grief counseling is also really misunderstood. You go to counseling when there's a problem that needs treatment. Grief does not need to be treated. It's not a problem. It's what's supposed to happen. When you have a loss, you have grief. No one's going to fix it. You shouldn't go trying to get it to be fixed, but this is America. This is what we do. We want to fix everything. We want to stop the pain immediately. I read an article the other day by someone that was about how to use plant medicines and flower remedies to heal grief. And I just wanted to punch my computer when I read that. It's like, no, you can use the flower remedies and the plant medicine to ease anxiety and perhaps address depression or something like that, but you don't put medicines on your grief to make it go away. And the medical community is all for doing that now. Some of you may know that grief is now a diagnosable condition in the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual as of 2014. And it says that if you are showing certain symptoms of grief, like depression, crying every day, obsessing about the lost person, there's a whole list. If you're doing this for more than 6 months, you can be diagnosed with pathological grief and given medication.
Oh boy.
6 months. Yeah, and this is a huge controversy in the grief world. You know, the medical establishment likes this because the pharmaceutical companies make more money when you just medicate everybody. And, you know, the real grief counselors just think this is horrible because if your 85-year-old father dies of a nice, peaceful death at home or in hospice, and you're still crying every day for 6 months, yes, there is something pathological going on there. There is a normal trajectory of recovery that we are expected to do. And 6 months of daily crying for your 85-year-old father who died a natural death at home is a little bit off the charts. So there's all these specific things. Now, if your child was run over by a car in front of you, 6 months of daily crying is perfectly fine. You see the difference? And so this pathological diagnosing thing that they're trying to do doesn't make for those fine tuning things. So if someone comes to me who saw their child run over by a car, and I do have a client who did see that, as far as I'm concerned, they can cry every day forever. Yeah.
How do you separate PTSD and grief?
Well, it's called complicated grief. And so PTSD, I'll give you a good example. I talked to a woman the other day who witnessed at Burning Man, the guy who walked into the fire. She was standing right there and saw that happen. And she's on the staff at Burning Man, and she didn't go back this year because she had PTSD over that traumatic thing. So with PTSD, you don't even say PTSD and grief in the same sentence because they're so completely different. Grief is grief. You're grieving over your mother's death, your spouse's death, your child's death, your dog's death. That's all in the normal realm. PTSD is when something happens that is so outrageous, such an affront to your system, to your assumptive world, your reality, that you can't regain balance again. And you're traumatized and you're in a state of post-traumatic stress, which can happen with grief. But I would say to keep grief in a separate realm and treat those two things.
Right. Well, I guess the real question is, if you've got PTSD, you're not in a normal place where you can actually grieve, or am I wrong?
You can't really say that. It's not true for everybody.
Yeah, it's like trying to compartmentalize them if they both. If you just saw someone run over, you would have both.
And what I would do with someone like that is I would try to separate them, because I would try to get them to do the grieving.
Yeah.
Because to ignore the grieving because you're so focused on the PTSD is there's that dark cancerous thing that's not getting addressed. So this is a really good segue to my personal approach to how to work with grief, which is through ritual and ceremony. Which is what we're going to do tonight. We're going to do a little practice on this. So borrowing from other cultures, looking at what they do in Africa, what the shamans do in South America, because it's about moving that stuck energy of grief, we use symbolic representations and rituals to move our grief forward, to take it out of the body. So, for example, in my workshop that I teach around the country, and I'm having one here in Sebastopol, by the way, on September 22nd. I've got flyers here I'm going to give you guys. We do ceremonies and rituals to move the energy. So, for example, it's a full day, sometimes it's a whole weekend workshop, but one of the things we do is something called a kintu from Peruvian shamanism. So we'll have a table with a ball of rose petals and a pitcher of water, and we'll take a handful of rose petals, and what the shamans do is they blow into them all your pain, all the stuff that's in your body that's contracted. Blow it into the rose petals, put it in a bowl, pour a little water over it, and each person does this in a very sacred, silent space. And in the end, when everybody's done, we have this bowl that contains all that painful energy that everybody put in there. And we go outside and we pour it into the earth as part of a ceremony, because the earth can hold all that, and these little bodies cannot. That's how you get PTSD, is that you're holding it and there's no tools for releasing it. So that's just one example of the way that we move it from the body into a symbolic object of some kind and put it somewhere bigger than us. So Mother Earth is bigger than us. And sometimes we blow into a stone. So we'll just pick up a little stone like this and just blow it into the stone and bury the stone in your garden. Because the stone has been here for billions of years and is big and strong and can hold all that for you. Or this little fleshy thing that we live in can barely handle it at all. So the idea is to get it out of ourselves and into something bigger. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk briefly about types of losses before we do our little ceremony. So I'm going to kind of go through this pretty quickly, but usually when we're talking about grief and loss, we sort of default to death. But it isn't only death. Obviously, there's relationship loss, if you get divorced or abandoned, of course. There's material loss, if you lose your job, if you lose your house. A story that I like to tell a lot about this is I bought a motorhome last year. It was my dream for years and years, and I planned this big trip. I was going on a speaking tour, and I planned it for 6 months, and on day one, I drove out of my house in Sebastopol off to go to my trip to Oregon, and it broke down in Santa Rosa and got towed to the shop, where it stayed for the next 2 weeks, and I had to still go on my speaking tour. I had to rent a van. It was just terrible. But I was grieving the whole time, and it was like, wow, why did this happen to me? Maybe I needed to learn about material grief. And even though I've lost a house, you know, and I've lost plenty of jobs and money, it never hit me until that. So that's my example of material grief. And if you look at what happened in America in 2008, where everybody lost their house and their job, we now had national grief and national pain of the material kind. There's also what they call intrapsychic grief, which is when you lose your identity. So if you are a wife and a caregiver and your husband dies, you are perceived by yourself to not be a wife anymore. Now you're a widow. And you're not a caregiver anymore. Who am I? What am I? I don't have an identity. If you're a corporate CEO and you get fired, you lose your identity. And that's a big one for men, tend to identify so much with their job. So there's that kind of loss. One of the most interesting ones for me is called system loss. When a system that you trust doesn't serve you. This can happen with your church, your religious structures, when you realize one day that all of that structure isn't really giving you what you thought it was going to. This can happen with a corporation that you depend on. This can happen with a political system. I think many, many, many people in America right now are grieving from system loss because our system isn't working the way we expect it to. There's also anticipated loss, which is easy to understand. If you're caregiving for a dying person, you're anticipating their loss. Unanticipated loss, your husband goes scuba diving and never comes home. Sympathetic loss, you feel, you know, when I hear somebody tell the story of their dog dying, I cannot stop crying. I feel that loss sympathetically. Tribal and national loss is real important. We were talking about this earlier. Think about how many people in America are carrying with them the collective ancestral memory of tribal loss. Every black person in America, every Native American, Native Hawaiian, Japanese person has experienced this marginalization, the robbing of their culture, the robbing of their identity, and here we all are every day just functioning like everything's fine, and that is so deep inside us, just carrying that tribal and national loss. Relinquishment loss is really interesting. If you give up something voluntarily, if you're the one who leaves the marriage, you still feel a loss, right? Even though you are the one who initiated it and relinquished it. When you quit smoking, you miss your cigarettes. So that's relinquishment loss. And then finally, loss of autonomy. I think a lot about prisoners. There are a lot of people in prison, young people who did nothing but smoke a joint, you know, and now they've lost their freedom and their autonomy and their identity. So I just wanted to give you all of that so that you realize that we're not just talking about a death. Any comments before we move on to the next thing?
What about, like, when you realize, I guess it, like, giving up the way you thought life was supposed to be, or that, you know, oh, I was living this lie.
Right. That's the
end. The dream that you had, that you come to your senses and realize, what was I thinking?
Or you don't come to your senses, it just goes away for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So that's like intra-psychic loss. And so this happens a lot. So this brings us to assumptions. There's a great book called Shattered Assumptions that is really helpful about this. We all have certain assumptions that allow us to live. So I assume when I get in my car and drive to town to go to the store, that I'm going to go to the store, buy the groceries, and go home and make it home alive. And my dog will be there waiting for me, and everything will be the way it's supposed to be. We assume when we get married that our marriage is going to last. We assume when we get a good job that that job is going to give us enough money to buy a house and have a spouse and get a dog and have some kids and do all these things that make life happen. This is all based on assumptions. And then we find out the marriage ends, the house goes into foreclosure, the dog runs away, the kid dies, all this stuff happens. And that's the kind of loss that you're talking about, when your assumptions are shattered. So the Buddhist perspective on this would say, don't have those assumptions, or don't be so attached to those assumptions. Know that anything that you have can disintegrate at any moment. And I personally think that's a really good way to look at things. But in our culture, we are taught to hold on to everything, to claim it and own it and keep it intact, a fight to the death, including our own bodies, right? We're not allowed to die. So, I mean, I've worked in many hospitals as a chaplain, and I have seen people, you know, in their 80s, early 90s that are on dialysis and chemo in the hospital room crying and saying to me, why can't I die? My wife won't let me die. My wife keeps, you know, wanting to keep me on all these machines. Can you please tell my wife to let me go? You know, and do you know that 40% of the entire Medicare budget in America is spent on the last 12 months of life, and 25% of that is spent on the last 30 days of life? And I don't know how much that translates into dollars, but it's probably billions. Don, you could probably calculate that real fast, couldn't you? Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's all about the assumptions, right? And the clinging and the holding on to things being the way that we want them to be. You know what's the number one only thing that is ever a problem in any relationship? It can all be boiled down to one thing.
Assumptions.
Well, yes, all of those things. Or you can put it more simply, like, you won't do what I want you to do. That's it. It's all that. There isn't anything else. So we live in this world of constantly, like, white-knuckling control of everything. And these traumatic grief experiences in many ways come to teach us about letting go. And I don't know how much you know about my personal story, but I got into doing this work because my child died. My son died when he was 16. He was diagnosed with a rare illness when he was 10, and it was progressively degenerative. So I had so many anticipatory losses. I watched him go from being a normal child to being total care in a wheelchair, couldn't walk, couldn't talk, couldn't use his body. So that's why I'm here today, teaching this. And when you have someone like that in your life, they are the greatest teacher, because they teach you how to very slowly release your grip on how things are supposed to be. So one of the things I want to do... What does that say? 10 after 8? Okay. So again, I'm going to go back to the ritual and ceremony. If grief counseling isn't really going to help us, because just sitting and talking to somebody week after week doesn't, it helps a little, but it doesn't move the energy forward. If grief groups are only going to keep us telling our story over and over again, if our friends and family and support system really isn't going to support us because they're uncomfortable around our grief, what do we have? We have other people who are really working to go deeper. And there are wonderful groups that do that. There is a grief ritual that happens around here that Francis Weller does, and that's what he learned from Simone Trousseau-Me. That's a good example of going deeper, is using ritual and ceremony and communal grieving. I've heard it called communal liturgy. Liturgy is a really beautiful word. My education is in counseling and religious studies. I realized that if I was going to help people with grief, the first thing I needed to do was learn about all the religions so that I could talk to Christians and Muslims and Jews and atheists and everybody else and speak their language without judgment. So I got a really intense education in religion, and I sometimes use words like liturgy because it's beautiful. And a liturgy is just kind of the processes that you do in a ritual or in a gathering of some kind. So communal liturgy is what you can do with these rituals and ceremonies. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, so let's just do this. There's a wonderful book, and I bet they have it here, The Smell of Rain on Dust. Do you know that?
Yeah, we got that.
You have that. Good. Martin Prechtel is this beautiful shaman. He's from New Mexico. He's a white American, but he grew up among the natives in New Mexico, but also somehow ended up being an initiated shaman, Mayan shaman, in Peru someplace. I don't know the whole story. But he tells this beautiful story of something that you can do with a dying person. So let's say you're sitting next to someone who's dying, and you have this beautiful blessing opportunity to sit with them like this. So let's say I'm sitting with my mother, and you do something called a story string. So I sit there with her, and I wind up the string into a ball, and I tell her story. I remember when you taught me how to ride a bicycle. And then there was that time when you wouldn't let me wear my new party dress to play in the mud. And then I remember when Dad died, how sad you were. And then I was a teenager and I told you I hated you all the time. I really didn't hate you. And then I got married and you were so happy. And then blah blah blah, and you tell, and then mom, you know, then you found a new husband and he was really good to you, and then you got cancer and da 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 da, and you have your mom's whole story in this beautiful little ball. And then when she dies, you put this in the casket, or you cremate it with her. So she takes her story with her to the afterlife, or to the oneness, or whatever you want to call it. Fabulous, beautiful ritual. So I learned that from Martin Prechtel, and I changed it into a grief story string. And so in our short little time together tonight of 1 hour, I thought we would try this. I want you to just take one and pass it along. And I'll tell you what we're going to do with this. I love that the Day of the Dead is right standing here behind me. This is wonderful. If you don't have a Day of the Dead altar, how many of you have an altar in your house? Oh my gosh, that's wonderful.
Sebastopol.
Yeah, I know. I moved here from Portland, so I'm used to it. It's great. That's great. So you're going to get a chance to use your altar with this stream thing that we're going to do. In fact, I wonder. All right, well, while you're getting the strings, I'll tell you what we're going to do. So we're going to do a story string like that, too. But what you're going to do with this string is tell the story of your loss, whatever your loss story is. It could be your whole life story. But don't start doing it yet. Of, you know, your father left when you were 3, your mother died when you were 5, the kids bullied you in junior high. Whatever your trauma and your story is that you want to release right now, tonight. And the way we do, has everybody got a string? Are we almost ready? Okay. It's amazing what you can do with yarn. The people at the yarn store would have never thought that that's what we were going to do with this. So we're going to put on some music. Rob doesn't know about the music that we were going to do, I don't think.
I understand that I just need to turn it on.
Is it ready to go?
It's ready to go. Just turn the volume up.
Okay.
So just, we're going to have some music. This is going to take like 3 minutes.
I'll wait.
And just kind of go into yourself, and it might make you sad, probably will, and do that. If you get to the end of the string and you still have more, unwind the string again and just do it again. Okay, and so let's just take 3 or 4 or maybe 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Do we do it out loud?
No, well, you can if you want, first but you don't have to.
Okay.
We're just going to listen to this pretty music and do our string.
Thank you. that's just the first part of it. Can you feel how powerful that is?
Yes.
How that takes it out of you? So the second part, what we do in the workshops, which we aren't able to do here tonight, is we do several little rituals with this, but ultimately in the end, when we go outside with the rose petals and the water, is we take these and we hang them in a tree. And then you have this tree with these beautiful ribbons with all of people's stuff that they want to release, their prayers for healing, given to the element, like the Tibetan prayer flags, which are supposed to disintegrate to show us impermanence, but also they release the prayers to spirit, to God. And so we put these in a tree and let the earth, the sun and the rain and the wind carry this stuff away to spirit. So we've moved it out of our body into a bigger space. What I would like you guys to do with yours, since we can't go outside and put it in a tree right now, is to keep it with you until you get home. Women, you can put it in your bra. I like to have it right here next to my heart. Men can put it in your pocket next to your heart. I always have to say that, so it's terrible. And take it home with you. And put it on your altar, if you have an altar. If you don't have an altar, if you want to do this, create a little sacred space in your house that becomes an altar with perhaps an object that represents the pain that you want to release and the healing that you want to do. And keep it on the altar to sort of let it purify in that space. And when you're ready, take it outside and tie it in a tree or bury it in your garden or throw it in a river. We don't have a lot of rivers here. I came from Oregon where there were rivers everywhere. We used to do that a lot, but burying it in the earth is beautiful. So you're giving it to Mother Earth, and all that stuff that you put in here, you're going to dissipate energetically or in the tree to the air. So we've got the earth, the wind, the water, and the fire. We'll take that and give it to the elements. You guys going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would like to hear from you about how that goes after you do it and how you feel. If you want to write something about it, another thing you can do, and you can do this at home with another string, is get another string, and instead of putting your pain story in it, in this string, put your prayers for healing. So it's sort of the opposite of what you put in here. What you've envisioned for yourself. I'm not going to be angry anymore. I'm going to give up jealousy. I'm going to give up the anger that I had for my father for abandoning me 50 years ago. Whatever you want to put in there that you're releasing, which will kind of match what you put in the first string, and bury that one too. Put them both in the tree. The idea is to just open it up and ventilate it and release it. Any comments on how that felt to anybody to do that?
Yeah, I reached a point where there was really a shift where I went to the joy and the pleasures, the wonderful things that have happened in my life, and recalled that in co-counseling, they found that a person has to release all their negativity before they get to the positive things.
Right, and one of the things that's a great point, when you're telling the story, about halfway through the string, you can go, I'm so sick of this story. I've been telling this story for 60 years. You can actually see the point in the string where you don't want to be identified with that story anymore. And I've had people in my workshops who've come up to me and say, I need 5 strings. One string isn't going to be enough. And that's always the person in the room who wants everybody to know that she is more traumatized than you are. And, you know, makes a big point of saying very loud, I need 5 strings, I have that much trauma. And, you know, and that person I'm thinking of who did that is a person who, no matter what, is not willing to and is not ready to let go of her story. But this is a step in not being identified with your story anymore. So your story, you know, it's like, God, I am so sick of calling myself a sexual abuse survivor. I think I'm going to stop doing that now. Then you do the other string. I am not calling myself a sexual abuse survivor anymore. And put that in the tree. And here. Very, very powerful stuff. This stuff will shift. So don't do it unless you're really ready to let it go, because it will. And so this is the kind of stuff that that we lack in this culture. Very rarely are you going to go to a therapist or a grief counselor who's going to give you a string and tell you to do this, or give you rose petals or stones to blow into. And this is what we need. You know, this is where I would like to see grief counseling and psychotherapy heading in the future. And I'll give you an example of that. My young nephew just finished a double residency in pediatrics and ER. Very ambitious, hardworking kid. And he had a very, very horrible, traumatic case in the ER. A man shot his two little daughters and himself. They all came in, and my little nephew had that case. And the two little daughters died, and the man lived. My nephew had to save him. So he had this ethical dilemma of why should I save this guy. But he was so traumatized by this, and as soon as he cleaned up his hands after that case, the next case was a woman bringing in her five-year-old for the sniffles. And he was like, I don't care about that kid with his stupid sniffles. Do you know what I just had to do? And he realized that he had no way to shift from that trauma to being the happy pediatrician to the five-year-old with the sniffles. And so he went to the hospital chaplain and he said, I need some way to transition, you know, to do something with this energy. And this was in Arizona, and it just so happened that the chaplain was a Native American who had shamanic sensibilities, who came up with this idea that in the doctor's locker room, where they come in and change their clothes and leave their wallets and things, she put a bowl of stones and a bowl of water. And she told the doctors, when you start your shift every day, take a stone and put it in your pocket. And as you go about your business, the stone will carry all that energy that you're collecting from all these people and all this trauma and all this loss. And at the end of the day, when you come back to the locker room before you go home, put the stone in the bowl of water. And so all the doctors started doing this, and the chaplain, the shaman, would every day pour out the water into the earth outside the hospital to take all that energy and give it to the earth, and then put the stones back in the bowl and a new fresh bowl of water. I was blown away when I heard that. I mean, I couldn't have even thought of anything as cool as that. Just amazing in the hospital. So wouldn't it be great if we could see this kind of stuff in the mainstream, in every hospital, doctor's office, schoolyard? How do you process something like a school shooting? You just can't. It's unprocessable. Talk about PTSD. So, you know, if it was up to me, aside from the support and counseling that those students and the parents and everybody's getting, I would set up some sort of ritual process in the school like that, like the doctors had. So rituals like this are really easy to make up. You can. There are no rules of how it should be done, except maybe that it should always be about releasing. You know, letting something go through you and then releasing it outward. Comments? Questions?
Yeah. A little confusion about releasing what I'm carrying as opposed to releasing memories of the person. In this case, my husband who died. I don't want to embrace him.
Right.
At all.
I'm glad you said that.
Can you repeat what you said, please?
She is concerned about sort of the overlap of releasing the pain and maybe accidentally releasing the memories of her husband. So I'm so glad that you said that. So these are two very separate things. The thing that you're releasing is the thing that doesn't serve you. So that's the pain that cripples you, the thing that makes you not able to breathe, not wanting to wake up every morning and live another day. That kind of, that heavy, sad depression, anger, why did this happen, feeling victimized, angry at the doctors or whatever. That's the stuff you want to release. The memories you put in that second string. And when you and you put your beautiful memories and all the love and the healing in that second string, and when you release that to spirit, it doesn't go away. It just opens. You know, your memories of your husband, nothing can ever diminish those. How long ago did he die?
About 6 months.
So 6 months is still really, really new.
Yeah.
And you may not be ready to do this process at all, because here's another important thing. Sometimes you want to hold your pain. And my feeling from you, like the lady with the scuba diver husband said the same thing. I don't want to let go of my pain yet. I need my pain to keep me connected to the event, and I'm not ready. And you may not be ready. You know, a year from now, you might be ready, because you'll be able to see that your husband still exists and is still present with you, and that there's this other part that you can let go of. But, you know, you probably haven't even taken his clothes out of the closet.
You're right.
Yeah.
Actually, you're right.
I know. That's a long process. And you'll know when it's time to do that.
That's what I figured I'd know.
Yeah. And let your friends help you, you know. But if they're saying, hey, you should get those clothes out of the closet by now, and I'm sure they have said that, you know, you just... Let me give you something that you could do with that. A woman, and again, this is a ritual, she had her husband's shirts made into a quilt.
I've heard of this.
Mm-hmm. So it was time to move the clothes out of the closet, and she found a quilter. She picked all the favorite shirts, and she gets this beautiful quilt, which she wraps around her, and it's like his arms around her, because it's his shirts wrapped around her body. So there are things like that you can do. So keep your mind open for creative rituals like that. And let people help you. You know, when people say, oh, I'm so sorry that your husband died, please let me know if I can do anything to help. What do we usually say?
Thank you.
Thank you, and no, it's fine, fine. The best thing you can do for a grieving person is offer to do something specific.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm going to come over next week and clean your bathroom. How wonderful. Wouldn't you have loved that in the first couple weeks after he died, if someone just came and cleaned your house? And instead of saying, can I go to the store for you? You say, I'm going to Costco today. What can I get for you? Don't leave it open-ended. Just make it an absolute thing. When my son was dying, 2 days before he died, one of my neighbors came over, this is where I learned this, and he said, I know this is kind of off the wall, but I happen to be going to Office Depot today and wonder if you need anything there. And I said, I need printer ink, because I was going to print up these little handouts for my son's funeral, and the last thing I wanted to do is get in the car and go buy printer ink, and here's this man who just walks right in and offers to do it for me. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful thing to offer a very, very specific...
I'd like to say something. My husband just died Sunday morning from Alzheimer's, which he had been suffering for several years, and I'm so happy he's not suffering.
Yes. Thank you for saying that.
And of course I feel numb. I can't cry. Now I can, but and you know, there's something in me, I can light my candle and play his music. And I guess I just have to wait for the tears to come. They will.
It's not even a week. You're still in numb.
It's like I'm guilty because I'm not crying all the time. Like you were saying, people cry all the time.
You know, there's an expression in grief that says, it's okay to be okay. Maybe you're okay. You know?
But he's been dying a long time.
Exactly. And you grieved. I'm sure you cried millions of tears over the last however many years, right? You know? I didn't cry when my son died. I cried a little. I cried afterwards. Something would trigger me, and I would start to cry. But immediately in the beginning, I didn't, because I felt weird too. But I felt like you. I was relieved that he wasn't suffering anymore. And I realized that I had been crying for 6 years. And I did my anticipatory grieving. And sometimes in a situation like that, you can do your grieving beforehand. You may be done grieving. Now you have the tasks of restoration to do next. And you may cry because you stub your toe one day, and then it will all come out. And any way that it does is fine. And it, not everybody cries. There's not a normal thing to do. And just bless you so much for coming here tonight. Just
it was hard.
What made you decide to come? You came with your friends, right?
My friend Betty Goodnick thought that I had the. She didn't say. I think she thought I had the courage to come.
Well, you do. You do have the
I do have a lot of courage.
That's so brave. I mean, really, you know, I generally tell people not to come to these talks until they're at least 6 months out, but wow, just bravo for you. You're amazing. Thank you. You're going to be okay, and it's okay to feel
I think
you.
So.
I mean, you said, the first thing you said, you were happy.
Yes.
You did say that, right? That was the word that you used. I get it. He's happy.
Well, I think I have a pretty good inner life. That makes a big difference.
Huge. When people say to me, I'm sorry that your son died, I say, I'm not. It was the worst thing and the best thing that ever happened to me because of my inner life. And it led me to what I do now so that I can talk with people like you. And share. A good ritual to do in your house that might help you with moving things around in the house, and it's a little soon for you. I had a client whose 9-year-old son died from leukemia, and he lived and died in that house, and after a few years, she and her husband decided to sell the house. So they put the house on the market. I guess they bought another house because the house was empty when we went there. So the house was all empty, ready to be sold. And she was just, you know, beside herself, I can't let go of this house. This is where my son lived and this is where he died. And she was just devastated about letting go of the house. So I said, well, here's how we'll do it. We'll do a ceremony. So we went in her house. And we took sage, and we went to every room in the house, and I told her to tell me stories about him in every room. So I'd be with the sage, and we'd go in the bathroom, and she'd say, here's where he was potty trained, you know, here was the first time he ever peed in the toilet when he was 2, and I was so proud of him, and she tells me that story. And then in the kitchen, here's where I always cooked his favorite food, and I taught him how to make scrambled eggs. And then here's where we sat in the living room and watched TV, and the whole house. And both of us were just bawling our eyes out the whole time. Both of us just crying and crying. It was so beautiful. And we just cleared the room of everything so that she could know that she was taking the beautiful stuff with her and taking it away from that house so that she wasn't leaving it in the house. It was carried in the smoke of the sage and in the tears. And then the other thing about this kid is he was a wonderful artist, and you know, you always have your kids' drawings, millions of them, and what do you do if the kid dies? You can't throw that in the trash. You can't just recycle the artwork. So what I had her do is I said, pick the things that you want to keep, and everything else we're going to take to the beach, and we're going to have a bonfire, and we're going to burn the rest of it, and again, we're going to give it to spirit. So you're not throwing the artwork away. You're sending it back to him, wherever he is out there in the universe. You're recycling the energy of the art. So these are all things that you can do at home. Oh, poor guy. He's grieving now. So any other comments? Because we're kind of running out of time. I will pass these around. I'm doing a full-day Greek workshop on the 27th at my house in West Sebastopol, if any of you would like to come. And my books are over there, if you're interested in that. And yes?
I guess I'd just like to say thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
It takes a long time. Because I would say that for a long time. It's just so silly to feel like that's the attitude.
It takes time, but time doesn't heal. You have to, there are things you have to do those tasks. So when someone says, don't worry, you'll be better in time, what happens in time is a scab grows over the wound. But if you just let time go by and don't do anything proactive, like these little ceremonies and all these tasks that we're talking about, it's not real healing. You've got to go inside to your inner resources for the healing to really happen. And it can all happen on the outside. You can go to grief counseling every week and go to support groups and read all the books and everything that you want, but if you're not doing at least some meditations, some art therapy, some symbolic representations, some sort of work with nature, with the elements, with the spirit, something, then it's more going to be just a scab covering instead of a healing. Rob is looking at me because...
Because I'm waiting for the conclusion to okay. Your remarks.
Okay, well, the conclusion to my remarks is that I am so grateful that you're all here, and I hope that this has been helpful for you. It's so rare when we have an opportunity to gather like this and talk about things like this. I mean, some of the words that have come out of my mouth are things that you would never say in mixed company. How often can you say, blah, 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 and then the kid died? I mean, these are crude words, it's crude language, but we're in a place where it's safe and you understand, you know, why we're talking like this. So what I would say to you is do your inner work. I can recommend the book, The Smell of Rain on Dust. If you're going to buy one book tonight, you don't have to buy my book. I would love it if you did, but I'd rather you bought that book. Because it's beautiful and heartfelt and will really give you some beautiful tools.
What's the name again?
The Smell of Rain on Dust. Rob knows what it is.
Unfortunately, it's way in the back.
Yeah. Is what you've presented tonight in any one particular of your
books? It's kind of spread out all over all of them. This book, A Swan in Heaven, is my first book. It's more of my personal story that begins on the day that my son died and how I began channeling him and talking to him. And then this second book is kind of what he taught me, and through shamanic work and deep meditations and stuff that I learned about how the journey of the soul works and birth and death. And this one is... for more advanced grievers, I would not recommend this for somebody in the first year of grief. It's called Turning the Corner on Grief Street, so it's sort of about now that we've done that heavy first year of shock and pain, what are we going to do next? So I guess in Grief Street is where you would find what is most resonant with what I'm saying.
That might suggest...
Yeah, they're rituals. There's actually rituals in all three of them. I think all three of these books have a section on suggested rituals. So they're very mystical, because I have had a lot of mystical experiences through all this. But the more practical, like, you know, things to do, practical application would be in Grief Street. Have I seen you before? Did you come to see me here once before?
Me?
Yeah, you're probably familiar.
I'm one of the founders of the store. So
oh,
I'm
amazing. So thank you, and thank you especially. I just honor you so much, and you for coming and sharing all this. You've been wonderful. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers. Many of you know I have a brief announcement. We have a donation bowl over there. We employ the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. So we share with our speakers that the contents of that bowl and retain half to further support such events coming up. And there are, of course, as Terry has just been saying, the books here that you can take a look at and purchase at your will. And I'm sure that she's willing to talk for a few minutes more individually here as we go forward. But thank you all so much for coming, and we'll look forward to seeing you at future such events. My gratitude.
Yeah, thank you. Well,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being a wonderful audience.
You know, it's interesting that when we've done talks with the deaf scene, usually it doesn't draw many people.
I know.
This is a refreshing alternative. The other thing I wanted to ask was that Rob and I do a radio show on the local cows, the local feed station.
Yeah.
But we do a podcast. It's called The Mystical Positivist. So it's conversations about contemporary spiritual practice. So I think you'd be perfect for the show.
I would totally love to.
So I'll contact you. I'll just send you an email and say, tell you when we have some available days. Probably in October.
Okay.
Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I think you can find. Well, you can find me through this website.
Okay.
You'll find
yeah.
Me.
So Saturday afternoon, 4 to 6 p.m. Here, come in the studio.
Sure, that'd
have
be
dinner
great.
Afterwards.
Oh, I'd love to. That'd be really fun.
Thank you. This is my mom.
Oh, that's your mom.
Yeah.
Oh,
hi.
I brought my Tuesday
Yeah. Oh, you.
She lives in Spring Lake.
Right. I heard that people from Spring Lake Village are coming. So thank you.
I think we only have one copy.
You know, I think for them, I think a lot of what it's going to be is they're still in the cloud. Yes, it is an altered state. No, because you can't. You know, when my son died, I felt like, I wrote this in my book, I felt like aliens had come and picked me up and took me to another planet and then put me back down in my life again. And something happened in between that I didn't remember.
We had done, when my dad died, we also were able to do a ritualized death. We kept the body for 3 days, and then we participated in the cremation, and we were able to meet the ashes out of ourselves.
That makes
such a difference.
Yeah. Well, that's how it used to be done before death became medicalized.
Yeah, it's beautiful to have that opportunity.
Did Jerry O'Hill
have it? Not directly, but actually Rob and I had a third partner who died in 1988. He was a spiritual teacher. A friend of mine at the time, it was like the National Death Care Project.
Right.
And so she came over and told us, and she showed us a book. She bought $35, a cardboard box.
Yeah.
Covered it with posters, and things like that, poems and messages and things like that. But all the flowers and the cuttings from the plants around the property. And put the box in the back of the station wagon and drove up to Santa Rosa Memorial and did the same thing there.
And you handled the bones. And I did a cremation there with Claudia Crusoe. And she took, the whole bones and put them in her garden.
Yeah. And so it was such a powerful grounding. The whole process just went through it. I knew it.
And you walk all the way through a process with the person. It's not like you leave them at the hospital and never see them again. You actually get to go beyond the hospital, beyond the family.
Yeah, and so we had, so Jerry had sort of inspired us to that, and so when my dad died,
Same thing.
He was in Arizona, so I had to talk to the funeral director a little bit, because he had no idea.
Right, yeah.
Why do you guys want to be there?
They still probably don't do that now.
He had fun. Once he got us there, he was like, Someone had shown such interest in his work.
He said, well, you've come this far, do you want to take the ash or something?
Yeah, so he gave
for
him
my children all.
Handed us the broom. So.
Yeah. I still have my own.
Yeah.
Because when I die, I have my ash.
You know, the angel is child. Yeah.
You know, I tell people about ashes, because as you know, it's a lot. You don't go and take them and just dump them in the ocean or someplace. You keep them and use them for things. I took my son's ashes and put them in little bottles and gave them to people too, who were traveling to take them all over the
You're
world
welcome.
And sprinkle them all over the world, because I always wanted to travel around the world with them, but I never got to. So. And you can use them in ceremonies and rituals. When I built my house, I put the ashes in the ground.
But when my ashes and my husband's are combined, there will be far too many more containers. So I want my kids to each take some and plant something, a memorial plant or tree or something, and use these ashes.
And then, I have no idea.
And you know, and they can still save some ashes because. You know, 20 years later, their kids are going to build a house, and that just becomes part of the family. My friend Don, right there, when his mother-in-law died, she had always wanted a coach purse, and she saved her penny, and she bought this coach purse, and now her ashes are in the coach.
She wanted me to marry her in the purse, but I would not. I put her in the purse and put her in the metal.
I thought